Get out of the fucking house. Get off your fucking computer, okay? It's a great broadcast, but go do something, you lazy fucks. You're listening to Culture Catch with Dusty Wright.
Joining me today on The Culture Catch is the wildly successful actress-comedian Susie Essman. You've come to love her as Susie Green in Larry David's HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm, as well as multiple Comedy Channel Friar Club roasts, episodic TV appearances, and in the new documentary from Think Films, The Aristocrats. Susie, welcome to The Culture Catch.
But also, wait, can I add another credit?
Yeah.
I have a movie coming out September 9th, The Man, with Eugene Levy and Sam Jackson.
She's going to be in The Man, September 9th. Susie, welcome to The Culture Catch. And I'm Dusty, by the way. Don't call me Mark.
Okay, Dusty. As in Springfield?
No, Dusty Wright, man. That's my stage name.
Oh, okay. I didn't know.
Yeah, I have an alter ego these days, man. What pissed you off this morning?
This morning? Oh, my fucking mother, you know? She's moving, and she refuses to make a decision. And I just wish, and this, there's no malice in this, I just wish she would just drown in a boating accident and disappear. I mean, you know what I'm saying? And it's not like I hate her or anything. It's enough with her. I did the analysis. I have all my material and my act about her. I don't need her anymore. And she's just a big pain in the ass.
So you need to get her to walk up with the steps so she has the heart attack.
I don't want her to suffer.
Oh, okay.
You know, yeah. That's why I thought boating accident is good. Like, that last minute going down would be horrible. But other than that, it's clean. It's not like a car accident seems so violent, you know? But you have to understand, I am so prepared. My dad died about 4 years ago, and I was so prepared for his death because for years, both my parents were telling me they wanted each other to, like, each other had, like, a deadly illness and disease and were dying, and then there was nothing wrong.
Right.
You know, so for years, I heard, your father had a stroke, and then there'd be nothing wrong. And my father would say, your mother has Alzheimer's disease, and then there'd be nothing wrong. You know, so I was, like, totally ready for their death. And I'm just waiting.
The parents that cried wolf too many times.
Exactly. Yeah. So when my dad died, Larry David actually called to give his condolences, and I said to him, well, one down, one to go. And he thought that was hilarious. But wait, can I just tell you one other story?
Yeah.
At my father's funeral, this is my mother, okay? This is what I'm dealing with. At my father's funeral, he was a great guy, my father. He really was. And there was all these people there and 17 speakers and everybody spoke about how great he was. And all my friends went over to my mother at the house afterwards and they said, oh, Mrs. Essman, he seemed like such a wonderful man. I'm so sorry I never met him. And to every single one of my friends, my mother said, there was a side of him we didn't talk about. So I'm prepared.
I mean, what do you say to that? What do you say to that? Now, when I spoke to you earlier in the week,
yeah.
You said, don't forget to remind you about the gay family cruise.
Oh, we just came. My boyfriend Jimmy and our kids, his kids actually, but I've appropriated them. We just came off the gay family cruise. Rosie O'Donnell does this gay family cruise every year, which is a wonderful thing because it's really for lesbian and gay couples who have children. You know, usually gay cruises are cruise scenes.
Right,
you know,
sure.
Big scenes. This is very family. And it was kind of wonderful to see all these gay parents and their children who weren't feeling ostracized. We were ostracized. We were the hetero minority. But I have to tell you, and I don't want to stereotype, I have never seen such obesity in my life as these lesbians.
Come on.
Oh, my God. One after another, and you'd see, like, two, like, huge, huge, huge fat women with the short, short, short mullet and, like, three black adopted kids. You know, that's all you saw all week long.
What's with the mullet?
I don't know.
When did that start?
Well, you know, it's like, how ugly can we make ourselves look? Let's just get completely obese and have a mullet and just, you know...
But obesity, come on, that's widespread in America. Obesity
is widespread
everywhere.
In America. You're absolutely right, and I see
Let's
it
upstate. Let's not stereotype.
Well,
because we're going to have Charles Kaiser on in a couple of weeks, the gay historian.
But listen, no one's more gay-friendly than me. I'm just telling you what I saw with my eyes. I actually could have just been on a regular cruise, which is all Midwesterners.
Right.
It would have looked the same.
Right.
But interesting, you know, my boyfriend lives upstate, so I go to all the soccer and softball games with the kids. And the soccer moms up there are like 3 degrees away from dykes. I mean, they all look like lesbians. They all got the shitty mullet haircut. They're all obese with the elastic waist pants and like the, you know, like the pink over top. And they've completely given up their sexuality, these women. You know, like they're wearing aluminum siding. Do you know what I mean? They've given up their rooms to store the kids' winter clothes or something. They completely gave up their sexuality.
What's Rosie say about it? Was she on the cruise with you guys?
Yeah, Rosie was there.
Right.
Well, they all look like Rosie.
Right. She's the patron saint.
Yeah, and as she should be, because she's really legitimized this lesbian mother thing, you know.
How many kids does she have now, Rosie?
She's got four. But, wow. You know, I'm nearsighted, and right. If I don't have my glasses on, like all the entire trip, I'd be walking down, you know, one of the decks, and I'd say to Jimmy, oh, there's Rosie. And it wasn't Rosie. There was so many Rosie lookalikes on the cruise.
Who knew?
It was hilarious.
What did
we
Jimmy
actually
think
had a great
about
time.
It?
Jimmy had a great time. Yeah. Jimmy's so cool. You know, we had a great time. The kids had a great time. It was a very warm kind of feeling. Great entertainment. Cindy Lauper performed one night.
Wow.
She was great. Melissa Etheridge performed. That's Judy Gold.
How about you? Did you do anything?
I didn't perform, no.
Why? Come on.
Nah, I
can't. You could have worked the room. You were working the room anyway.
Nah,
I know you.
They're too politically correct for me. Lesbians are a tough audience.
Are they?
Gay guys are my favorite audience.
Really?
Oh, they're
that?
The best. They're just a great audience. They always know what's good and what's funny. But lesbians are very politically correct. You say one thing a little politically incorrect, which I do many things.
Right. No, you know, come on. You?
Yeah, they're all over you. You know what's interesting about that? Larry was telling me recently that these super conservatives, like Tony Blankley, you know him?
No,
he's always
I don't.
On the McLaughlin Report. Super right-winger. They love Curb.
Really?
Yeah, because it's so politically incorrect.
So they just love...
They just love it because it's so politically incorrect. And nobody is more of a democratic liberal than Larry David.
Of course.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you are, too.
Yeah.
How did you and Larry... I was going to ask this down the road. How did you and Larry hook up? How did you get into the Curb
thing?
Well,
I knew Larry from years ago, you know, Catch a Rising Star, stand-up world, et cetera, but not
people
well.
Forget that he was a stand-up.
Larry was a stand-up,
yeah.
And either a very good or a very bad stand-up, depending on what your point of view. He was a comedian's comedian,
right.
As we say.
Right.
Which means that all the comedians would stand in the back of the room and be hysterical over him because his material was genius, but he had no ability to connect to an audience at all. He would do things like he would walk on stage. I remember when I'd MC at Catch a Rising Star, and there's always that point where you're crossing each other where I say, ladies and gentlemen, Larry David, and I walk off stage, and he walks off on stage, and he would always say to me, stay close, because you never knew how long he was going to be on. And sometimes he would just get up on stage, and he'd look at the audience and just say, never mind, and walk off. I'm not kidding. I've witnessed it. So it was not really his thing.
Right.
And yet he was a wonderful comic. So I knew him a little bit in those days, but not much. And then he saw me on Comedy Central on the Friar's Roast for Jerry Stiller.
Oh, God.
And he had
classic.
The part in mind for Jeff's wife, and he just called me and offered it to me.
That's great.
Yeah.
Now, people don't... they think you're a millionaire from the show. They forget how... You know, HBO is reality TV.
HBO, please.
Yeah.
Plus, the other thing is we only do 10 shows a season... Of which, this season I'm on 8. September 25th.
September 20th. People are waiting. I can't tell you how many friends... When I told him I was interviewing you, can I come over? I'm like, sorry, man. This is pillow talk time. You know, Richard's lucky to be here taking photos. He's leaving soon.
September 25th is, and this season's, oh, God, it's so funny. I think. I mean, I haven't seen it. I just know when we were shooting it, it felt so funny.
Yeah, when you guys are shooting, I mean, how do you get one take and that's it? I heard most of it's ad-lib.
No, it's all ad-lib. We do so many takes. We have to do a lot of takes.
Right.
Because it's improvised, there's no script, there's a very detailed outline. You
right.
know, Larry's all about story. When you see it, you see how well structured it
sure.
is and how many callbacks
the
there are and the layers.
Yeah.
And from episode to episode, too, he lays out the whole 10 episodes in detail. And each scene is very detailed, laid out of what has to happen in the scene and the purpose of it. But there's no dialogue written.
Right.
So we have to do tons and tons and tons of takes because the editors need so many takes for coverage, for cutting. Because we'll do a scene that's, you know, we take 15 minutes to do it, and they need it to be 3 minutes.
Right, I got
so they need tons of coverage.
So
do I need to explain that to the audience, what that means? People know what that means.
No, tell them.
Well, you shoot, you know, if we're shooting this scene between you and I, Dusty, there'd be a camera shooting you, there'd be a camera shooting me, there'd be another, then we'd reset up, and we always use two cameras.
Okay.
Then we would do a two-shot of the two of us together, from the right angle, from the left angle. Then we might do a wide shot. Then we might do a cutaway shot to Richard taking pictures,
right.
Which is always good to have a cutaway shot, because then you could cut to something.
Right.
And, you know, you do tons of different setups, and it is Richard, right?
Yes.
Okay. You do tons of different setups, and it's done in the editing. The editor cuts it together.
Right.
And if you watch Curb really closely, you'll see the continuity sucks.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'll watch it. Like, in one scene, you know, my hair is pulled back, and then this camera's on me again, it's down. You know, I mean, but Larry doesn't care about that stuff, and rightly so.
Because I watch pretty close. I've
funny.
Never noticed that.
You don't notice
it. And it is funny,
so funny.
If you would pick up on it. You'd
yeah,
go, well,
I notice it because I remember the day.
Oh, right.
You know, but it's so funny that you don't even notice it.
Well, how long does one show take to shoot then?
I think we do a 7-day shoot for
wow,
a half.
That's
yeah.
a lot of work.
And then he takes a month per episode to edit. He's editing right now. He's in Martha's Vineyard editing right now.
Oh, very posh.
Yeah, he's got a rough
Martha's
life.
Vineyard? Who edits in Martha's Vineyard?
Larry David. He's
is
a multimillionaire.
Is that where he does all the editing?
Well, he has a house there. He goes there with his family for the summer, and one of the editors goes out, and he brings all the equipment.
Good for him.
Yeah.
Well, that's what's great about this technology we were using, because it's just so remote.
Yeah.
Remote friendly.
We happen to be in New York City, which is the center of the universe, but we could be anywhere, couldn't we?
That's right, man. We're in Dusty's bedroom.
Is this your bedroom?
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's your bedroom.
No, it's my bedroom.
Not Richard's. Okay.
No. Richard's wife would never allow this. Are you kidding me? At what point in your life did you know you were funny?
Oh, God, I was always funny. I don't know when I knew. When I knew I could do this for a living is a completely different thing, but I was always funny.
You're the class cut-up?
You know what? I wasn't really the class cut-up. I was actually only funny with the people I really knew well, like my close girlfriends or my sisters and brother and my family. But I was the kid that said all the things that everyone else was thinking but wouldn't say. It wasn't necessarily funny, but I had the big mouth. Yeah, I got kicked out of school in fourth grade, you know,
for getting
a petition together to get one of the teachers fired who I thought was abusive.
Wow.
You know, so it's like I had no respect for authority whatsoever.
Right.
So I was more that to the general public than funny. I was more the mouth than the funny.
Did you do shows for the family and stuff?
Oh, yeah. I remember one year my sister got a little reel-to-reel tape recorder for Hanukkah.
Right.
And, you know, then I was just the talk show host. Then I was Johnny Carson and doing interviews all over the place. And, you know, that went off. Does that matter?
Oh, yeah, that's just...
Okay. I just want to make sure we're still recording.
We're 12 minutes.
And, you know, I was thinking about this, about my kids, how they are scheduled to within an inch of their life.
It's scary,
with activities. And, you know, we didn't do that. We made shit up. I used to write sketches and radio shows and song parodies and all the stuff that I now make a living with. You know, where Jimmy was saying, my boyfriend, you know, he's in construction. He was building go-karts and tree houses, and his kids don't know how to do that stuff.
No, you got to cart them everywhere.
They have no imagination.
My friends in the suburb go, your kids are in the city. It's so dangerous. And I go, well, what about all the kidnappings in the suburbs? So there's this, like, insane...
You know,
everything's
what?
Supervised.
They say that to me also about the city, and I think the city's a great place to bring up your kids.
I do too. Especially if you like to drink. You just jump in a cab.
It's so true. And in the suburbs upstate where they live, you always hear some like weird story about the kid who, like, you know, axed his parents to death, who lived across the street from the high school.
And,
you know what I mean? You wouldn't get Columbine in Manhattan.
No.
Because there's so much diversity and so much more acceptance of differences.
Right.
That... You know, weird, nerdy kids are allowed to just be weird, nerdy kids, and it's okay, and they're allowed to thrive that way.
Exactly. So at what point, then, did you know you could do it for a living?
I graduated from college. I was an urban studies poli-sci major. I was going to be a journalist.
Really?
Political journalist.
What school? Give a shout
out.
SUNY Purchase, all right.
And,
home of the Knicks. That's where they practice.
That's right. And, then when I graduated, I got into law school and decided, I don't want to be a lawyer. What the fuck am I thinking? And I started taking acting classes downtown at HB.
Uh-huh. Great
HB Studios. Yeah. And then I was doing that. I was like, you know, this is kind of boring. And then I was just waitressing and depressed and in a bad relationship. And the way I used to get through waitressing was I would go back to the kitchen and make fun of all the customers. And then friends that I worked with just kind of forced me to get on stage. I had never even been in a comedy club. I didn't really know that I could be a comic. I thought you had to write a new act every day.
Really?
Every night. Which is ironic for me because I've been doing the same act for 20 fucking years, you know? But so they kind of forced me to get up, and there were these guys there. I don't know if you remember the old Comedy U on University and 13th Street. Paul Herzig and Burt Levitt. And the first time I got up was downtown on Carmine Street, a place called Mostly Magic. They had an open mic.
Oh, yeah, I remember that place.
And I just did these characters.
Really?
Like my grandmother and,
Give us one. Come on, answer quick.
the president of the Menudo fan club. Remember Menudo was like this Hispanic. I used to do that. And
see, that's when I first met you when I was at William Morris. Oh, I loved you. I wanted people know I wanted to sign you. And I couldn't get anyone else. And that's in your early days, you know?
And I'm with William Morris now, actually.
God, and everyone's gone that was there that I know.
Thank God, except for you, Dustin.
Well, Brian Dubin's still there. He was there when
I was
there. Yes,
but I'm not with them commercially.
Ah, well, there you go.
They just hired me, these guys, to come work at their club. So I just worked at this funky downtown. It had all these like NYU students and gay guys in the audience, and I just kind of developed there. And I never thought of being a stand-up comic. It never occurred to me until
I did. You and Joy Behar, because Joy was a school teacher.
Yeah, well, that's where I met Joy down there, and you know, we're still best friends. Right. 21 years later. But that was where and after about a month, I was like, oh, this is the exact thing I was born to do.
Right.
And it was. I mean, it was the thing that I feel very lucky that I found the thing I was meant to do in my life.
Did you have a mentor back then?
Well, Joy was kind of my mentor. Joy was the first person I saw, because I used to just do character stuff. I never spoke in my own voice. And Joy was the first person I ever saw that I thought, oh, I get it. She's just being herself on stage. The way that I was when I was with my friends, sitting around the kitchen table, and they were hysterical. That's what she was like on stage. Same way she is on The View.
Right.
You know? So that kind of made me feel like I could just be myself and it would be okay. She was really my mentor.
That's great. Did you identify thematically with any female comedians or male comedians?
Pryor was my idol.
Right.
Yeah, Pryor was my idol. Because to me, Pryor in those days, and it's very sad to see him now,
no,
but
yeah.
Pryor had, remember that first concert movie he did?
The very first HBO?
It was a concert movie. No, it was released in theaters.
For the theater movies.
Yeah. I remember seeing that. And he just, you know, he had everything. He had he super, super funny. I mean, drop-dead funny. Vulnerable, honest, characters, stories, jokes. I mean, he just had everything.
I remember the Bicentennial Nigger record. Remember that?
Yeah.
They would never release a record with that title today. Well, maybe they
might. Chris Rock could do something like that.
Yeah, he could. But I remember playing that in college over and over and over again. That was my favorite comedy record.
Yeah.
Because
the characters
were just so...
And the irreverence and the truthful... And he's warm and truthful and honest. And to me, he was everything that a comic should be. Not like the comics I grew up with watching on Ed Sullivan. Not that there's anything wrong with them. They're hilarious. I just didn't see myself as that.
Right.
That
it was more of that Borscht Belt kind of thing. Shecky Green.
Right. And they're funny, you know, but I just didn't see me being that. I saw myself as something a little different.
So I didn't realize that you had the actress background, which really probably allows you to thrive with that spontaneity, too. When you see your act, I mean, you see how you riff off of people. It's so lightning fast.
Yeah.
A lot of comedians can't do that.
But that's why everybody always says to me, don't you find Curb so scary that you don't have a script? And I find it just the opposite.
Right.
I'm always afraid I'm not going to remember my lines. This pilot I just did, I was hysterical that I wasn't going to remember my lines. Oh, yeah. I'm not used to it.
Right.
I don't remember my act.
Oh, Christopher Guest mentioned that, too. He said, you know, when doing his movies, because they're all ad-libbed as well, a lot of actors want to be in his movies, but he says, frankly, if they can't ad-lib, and a lot of actors can't.
They can't.
They can't do it. They just can't, you know. I'm surprised you haven't done one of his movies. Have you ever auditioned?
You know, I haven't. I just did a movie with Eugene Levy.
He's so brilliant.
Oh, God, he's so wonderful. And such a nice man.
Right.
He is such a nice man. But, you know, I think they kind of, you know, on the Curb actress. I don't think they want to kind of mix those
things
so much. But there is actually somebody in Curb this year who is a wonderful actor who had difficulty improvising. I'm not going to mention any names. Well, but it's interesting.
Male or female?
I'm not going to say. But it's interesting because, I mean, I'm sure it came out fine, but it's interesting to see these incredible actors and you just take the script away and they can't do it. It's just a different talent. It's not better or worse. It's just a different ability.
Yeah. Yeah. Who was the first comedian who made you laugh until you couldn't breathe?
Gilbert Gottfried.
Really?
Gilbert Gottfried, to this day, I saw him the other night at the Aristocrats premiere, to this day can make me laugh harder than anyone in the whole world. And I think it's because he's retarded.
He is so out there, man. He is so out in real life. People who don't know him, when I was at the agency, the joke was, Gilbert, sign your papers. We represented him, but he never signed the papers.
Yeah.
And it was just like,
and he's still with William Morris all these years later.
He probably never signed papers for all I know.
Yeah.
And he just recently bought an apartment for the first time
in his
life.
Well, he lived with his mother for many, many years. His mother died a few years ago, which was sad because he was very close with her. But Gilbert hits my phony bone in a way that nobody else does. I don't know why. He could just get me rolling, like almost like a... a childish giggle, right. You know, like a third grade giggle.
I agree with you. He's so incredibly bright, too. That's the thing that's so scary about him.
I actually have real conversations with him. We're actually friends.
That's good.
Yes.
That's good to know. You know, I was never sure when I dealt with him, like, if he looked at me, like, you know, with disdain, like, oh, you're at the agency.
He is. Did you see The Aristocrats?
I haven't seen it. He didn't give me a ticket.
Oh! He's the funniest thing in it.
About that, but I'll get it.
He's the funniest thing in it.
Well, he was the impetus for the whole the concept.
Yeah. Well, from the joke. Yeah. Well, no, that's not really true.
It isn't.
No, I don't think so.
Because what I heard was, correct me if I'm wrong, the Friars roast for Hefner.
Right.
He tells a 9/11 joke. The audience starts booing him, and he goes into The Aristocrats. And
right.
I thought Paul or Penn saw that.
No, because I was there at the Hefner roast where he did the. I wasn't on the dais.
You weren't?
No, you're thinking of the Trump roast, probably, or Jerry Stiller.
Well, the Stiller I've seen a million times.
Yeah, but or Richard Belzer or the Smothers Brothers.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's the one where you cut Freddie Roman to ribbons?
I always do. I did that. I did that at the Danny Aiello roast. I did that at the Jerry Stiller roast. I did it at Belzer's roast. Freddie's my favorite foil. But if I recall, and I could be wrong, I think that Penn and Paul taped me doing that before that roast. Because then I remember seeing the roast and thinking, oh, he's doing that joke. I had never heard the joke.
Really?
I had never heard of the joke. Paul Provenza's a friend of mine. He's the director of the movie.
Right.
And he called me and said, could we come over and tape you? I want you to tell this joke. I said, well, what is it? He told me the joke, and I was like, all right, I never heard of it, but I'll tell it to you. I'll make my own version up. And I believe that was before the Friars roast, but I could be wrong. I could be wrong.
That's great. I mean, well, you could be rewriting history.
Yeah,
here.
I think I remember when I saw Gilbert doing that joke, I remember thinking, oh, he's doing the Aristocrats joke. I just taped that joke for Paul.
So they started that long ago, the project.
Yeah.
Wow, because they had it really, you look at the number of comedians, I was thinking, wow, when did they get all
these? I would say that was about 4 years ago.
Right. Right, 4 years ago.
I could tell by what I was wearing and where I was in my... I was in my old apartment, so that was at least 2 years ago.
Right.
And I think it was about 4 years ago. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they saw Gilbert and maybe they did it.
Can we hear your version of the joke, or does it ruin it for the movie?
Well, you know what? I don't remember my version of the joke.
Can you tell us the new version? A new version? How about that? Is that all right?
No, leave it for the movie.
Well, what's your favorite joke?
I don't tell jokes, Mark.
I
can't remember a goddamn fucking joke. Can't remember a joke.
I make fun of Richard.
Make fun of Richard.
Quit flashing the fucking light.
He's too
light,
cute.
Man.
See if he was a fat fuck or a four-eyed fuck or a bald fuck, you know, or a blonde fuck like you.
I like the one where you threw at Larry the time he had the hush puppies on. That was the best.
Oh, yeah. That was on the other night. I saw that the other night.
Oh, that's classic.
Yeah, when I'm showing him the T-shirts and he's like, it's not my cup of tea. And I'm like, fuck you and fuck your tea. But I got to tell you, he gave me some stuff to do in the upcoming season that is so funny. I would go back to my hotel room. You know, we shoot in LA, so they fly me in and I would stay in a hotel. And I'd go back to my hotel room. I'd be lying in bed by myself at night. And all of a sudden, I'd get uncontrollably hysterical laughing over what we shot that day.
I love the one where Gina Gershon wants to fuck him.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to fuck or am I going to do your laundry?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, the stuff is just classic.
My favorite of all the episodes is The Doll. That's my all-time classic favorite.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's my favorite.
Tell the audience the premise, because a lot of people don't get HBO. It's amazing.
Oh, well, the premise... Oh, how do I... See, that's why it's very hard to tell premises of Larry David shows, because there's so many different things going on. But the premise from my character's point of view is that he needs the head of a certain particular kind of doll, the Judy doll, and he comes to my house and he steals my kid's doll's head. And then, you know, it's decapitated and my daughter freaks out, so I have to confront him on it.
That's so classic. Do you guys curse in front of the kids or do you do cutaways?
Try not to. Sometimes we have to, but we try not to.
And do the stage mothers go ape shit?
No, you know, Larry's very prudish.
Is?
Oh, yes. He's very, very much a prude, and he doesn't like to, you know, he's very careful about what you say in front of the kids. You know, he'll do an episode about a kid who has a big penis. I think that was season three.
Right.
There was a whole episode
right.
where they were calling the kid Uncle Milty, which,
right.
you know, because Milton Berle supposedly had a huge cock.
Only take out enough to win. That was the old Friars joke.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, he'll do an episode like that, but he doesn't want to do it around the children.
Right.
Got to be very careful around the children.
What is the difference between vulgarity and then doing blue material? At what line?
What's funny? Right. I think it's what, although vulgar can be funny. I don't know. You know what? For me personally, it's like a little thing that's crawling up my spine. Just a little feeling that's crawling up
tangle.
My spine.
Yeah, a little
could feel like, you know. I also think that a lot of it has to do with content. You know, I mean, the Aristocrats joke is about as vulgar as you're going to get. It's
right.
a filthy, vulgar, bad joke. It's not even a good joke.
Right.
Which is why it's so interesting that they did this whole movie about it.
Right.
And yet, I found the movie fascinating.
To see everyone do it, and to see the guys that really make it work, and the other guys, like everyone's talking about Bob Saget, because he's so squeaky clean.
Saget is so funny. Saget is not what you think he is.
He was on Entourage a couple of weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
playing this character, and it was just so, you know, because they're used to America's Home Video, and, you know.
What was it, Full House?
He was, Full House.
Whatever.
I
he's
know.
A very funny man.
How did you break into the Boys Club of Comedy, the Friars Club? How did that happen?
Oh, you know, the Friars Club. First of all, the Boys Club of Comedy was, you know, just working in the comedy clubs when I started in the 80s, in
right.
the late 80s. Oh, it was such a boys club. It was ridiculous. And you scratch the surface of every male comic and, you know, underneath, they don't think women is funny.
Right.
Women are funny. They
to
just
this
don't
day,
think women
that,
are funny.
Is that true?
I think it's changed now. I see
yeah.
the younger comics much more respectful, but then they kind of have to be because of the position I'm in.
Right.
But in my day, you know, they would say things to me like, you know, be a catch or comic strip or something, and they would say, you know, the male comic, the MC who was horrible or something, would say to me, they're a very rough crowd, you don't want to go on.
Really?
Oh, yeah, stuff like that. And I would just be like, really? Watch me. And it made me
really
tough and really strong. But now I don't want to do that anymore, you
right.
know. And then the Friars Club, same thing. They didn't let women in till I guess, about 15 years ago. Women
right.
weren't allowed in, and women traditionally were not allowed into the roasts. So I had to really work hard at the roasts. I've learned how to be a great roaster. And the way to do it is you have to be incredibly prepared.
Right.
And a lot of these guys would get up, I don't want to mention any names, and just wing it, and they die. You can't do that at a roast. A roast, you got to set up punch. You got to bang it out.
Right.
And I had to kind of beat them at their own game. And I remember the first roast I did was Danny Aiello's roast, where he cried in the end because Richard Belzer read his really bad reviews of Della Ventura.
Ooh.
That's at the roast. Ooh. That's what Belzer did. He read the reviews, and the reviews were scathing.
Oh, my God.
I mean, scathing.
Oh, my God.
You know,
God.
And then in the end, Danny got up to speak, and he just started crying.
Oh, God. That's the ultimate compliment.
In a room like there was like 2,500 people in
Were
there.
You the only woman?
No, Joy was actually the roast mistress.
She was. So it's kind of like... Are there
but she was the first female roast mistress in 93 years.
Wow.
And I was the second. And since that, there have been no others.
Which one were you at?
Smothers Brothers.
Smothers, right.
Yeah. Dickie Smothers. You know, can I just tell you something about Dickie Smothers?
Yeah.
I had never met them, and Belzer was supposed to be the roastmaster, and then he had to shoot, so I had like 2 days to prepare, and they called me in, and I meet him backstage first, and first thing he said to me is, are you a Christian?
No, come on.
I swear to you, and I was like, no, I'm not a Christian, and then he started like pontificating because he's born again, of which I said, you know what, Dickie, at the Friars Club, this den of Judaism, this is not the right place to do this, you know? So then we go through the roast, and it was actually a very funny roast. And, you know, it's always freezing in that room. So he says to me, this is right after he said, are you a Christian? And the next conversation I have was like a few hours later after the roast where he comes up to me and he says, you know, I was just staring at your nipples the entire afternoon.
Nice.
Yeah,
exactly. And he's Christian.
Exactly.
Yeah.
My point.
Oh, man. And now Susie's a babe, so, you know, I can see that would come as a high
but
compliment.
The hypocrisy.
The hypocrisy.
Thank
the
you,
good
Dusty.
Lord was... Good God.
But yeah, I had to really, you know, you got to really prove yourself with those guys. You know, I had to make Alan King laugh. It was not easy.
Ooh. Who's the toughest guy you've ever had to roast?
Well, you know, I can't really say because I've turned those down.
Smart.
Yeah, you know.
Why set yourself up for failure?
I mean, if I don't really know the person or they're not roastable... You know,
not roastable.
Some people aren't that roastable. Like, I didn't know Donald Trump for the Donald Trump
right.
roast, but he's so roastable.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, oh.
I mean, I started off that roast by just, it was a luncheon, and I just said, Donald, what did your hair order, the salmon? You know, something like that. And you know, he wouldn't shake my hand because they say it's because he's a germaphobe. But really? I think it's just because he jerks off so much he considers anything else cheating.
Have to get a prenup for that.
Yeah, exactly. But he was so roastable. So, you know, like the Chevy Chase roast I turned down?
Really?
Yeah, everybody did.
Oh.
Yeah, I didn't know him at the time. I met him since then. But he didn't seem particularly roastable to me. And everyone who knew him didn't want to roast him because, I don't know, you have to ask them. So they kind of hired mercenary roasters.
Himself, or he's too
no,
serious.
He doesn't really have a sense of humor about himself. He was very pissed off at the end of that roast. He was pissed off that Al Franken talked about his drug use in the 70s. Hello?
Yeah, exactly. Who didn't use drugs?
Yeah.
God. Oh, that is funny. That's funny. Any other tidbits of roast tidbits?
Well, you know, my fondest memories of Jerry Stiller roast because that was so much fun.
They put him in that big cushy chair.
Yeah, he's such a sweetie. But actually, the best roast I ever was at was the Belzer roast.
Right.
And since he's one of my best friends, he was the easiest for me to roast.
Right.
You roast the ones you love. They're roasting Don King this year. I have nothing to say to Don King.
Yeah. Who would you like to roast that you haven't roasted?
I don't know.
I guess Larry. Yeah, Larry's
Larry
the obvious.
Larry will never be roasted, but I would love to roast
Why?
Larry.
Why? He wouldn't agree to it, you know?
No, never.
Why?
No. To Larry, that's
too
like
neurotic?
The last thing in the entire world he would ever want to do is be roasted.
Wow.
But I would enjoy roasting him.
Wow.
Or Jeff. I'd like to roast my fat fuck husband, Jeff.
And he's a very funny man.
Oh, he's great.
Now, did he really work the comedy circuit as well?
Yeah, I knew him from years ago. The thing that he lives in L.A., but when he comes in the city, we always get together because we're close friends for many years. And people freak out when they see us together.
Must.
They just freak out and they can't believe we're friends and we like each other and we're sitting at dinner having normal conversation, laughing, and they're just staring at us in disbelief.
Do you ever goof on people when they like hit you? I think it was last year you told me people come up to you and say, yeah, guys will say something dirty to me.
Yeah, people constantly want me to tell them to go fuck themselves. But the weird thing is that they're disappointed when they meet me.
Why?
Because I'm not Susie Green.
Yeah, because you're
I'm a relatively normal,
yeah,
you know.
I see you shopping at Filene's in
yeah,
the neighborhood.
Exactly, exactly. They see me at Zabar's. A woman shoves her cell phone in my face at Zabar's. It's my husband. Tell him he's a fat fuck. I'm just like, you know, I'm looking at the whitefish. I'm not in the mood. But yeah, they're disappointed when they meet me.
People forget that there is a veil there.
I know.
And they just.
It's called acting.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, thank God you're in New York because at least New Yorkers will give you a lot more space.
They do, but when I'm upstate, because I'm upstate a lot, you know, at Jimmy's house, they act a little weird to me. They're so not used to, they've never seen anybody who they've seen on TV, and they're kind of rude without meaning to be.
Really?
Yeah.
They kind of whisper to each other?
Yeah,
and they
they're just weird, and it's just weird for them. Television, it's more than movies even, they do weird things.
Somebody said that once, I was reading a story, I don't know, I think it may have been Clooney was in the height of his TV, or had just gotten out of the TV thing, was doing a press junket with another star. And nobody really gave a hoot about the star because everyone knows TV stars.
Right.
They may not see the movie, so they knew him from that character. And they were like, oh, you know.
Yeah. Screaming. Television is very powerful.
Yeah.
Very powerful.
So the power of Larry David afforded you the CBS pilot.
CBS pilot, which was great. We have to wrap up in 2 seconds.
We do.
Yeah, well, I have to go meet my mother, who's annoying me and look at an apartment. But the pilot was great. It didn't go, you know. They kind of, in the end, they made me into Donna fucking Reed, you know. It just did. They hired me because they wanted me.
Right.
But then it just got very watered down. But you know what, Mark? You know what, Dusty?
Yeah.
I took their money.
Thank God. Hallelujah. And you
and
deserve it,
And I learned a lot. And I learned a lot. And I learned I could do so much of a better job next time because I learned so much. It was like really an intense learning curve.
Did you get to write it yourself? Were you the head writer,
too? No, Tom Leopold wrote it.
Okay. Tom is a very famous TV
Wonderful writer. Yeah. But I'm just not used to so much interference. We don't have that on HBO.
Right, because they have the censors. You can't do this. You can't say that. And
yeah,
everything.
And more than the censors. I mean, we kind of knew censor-wise what we could do and couldn't do. It was more just a lot of too many hands, too many people. Cooks in the stew or whatever that what's the expression whatever too many people meddling and you know so then you try to please this one and then the next person gives you contradictory advice and then it was very difficult for me
right. You've been listening to Susie Essman on The Culture Catch. We'd like to thank our sponsor today, Final Draft. And we have a copy of Final Draft for you, Susie.
Oh.
Is that great?
That is great. And I just fucking bought one.
Well, you get the upgrades and everything
okay,
now.
So what?
And I'll make sure of it because they're very, very...
I just bought it online.
God, we'll sell it on eBay and we'll get you another one. And we'd like to thank our engineer, Dave Lee, and Richard on photos today. You've been listening to Dusty Wright's Culture Catch. We hope you tune in soon. We'll have some more fascinating guests for you.